The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com. The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com. The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Welcome to Ness and Dormer, episode 13, part 2. The episode had gone so long we decided to split it over two. So this is the second part of the British Transfer Records episode with myself, Lee Calvert, Rob Smythe, Gary Naylor and John Silk. Enjoy. We move on back to the transfers now and we'll talk about, we're into the 90s. Just to start with, 1990 in the other parts of the world saw Roberto Baggio going from Fiorentina to Juventus for 8 million quid. What I loved about transfers back then is that we see it as 8 million quid, but it was like 27 gajillion million lira, wasn't it? Which you can never quite understand. So I miss that, really. One thing I miss about old football, transfers in lira. But yeah, so Baggio went there. Let's cover the next two that we've got here in one go in many ways, although Gary might not be happy about that. Because in 1991, in the same summer, for the same amount of money, 5.5 million each, David Platt went to Bari from Villa, Trevor Stephen went to Marseille from Rangers.
Yeah, well, I mean, Trevor Stephen was a Rolls-Royce of a player, and his biggest successes, if we're not counting sort of winning multiple titles in Scotland with Rangers, did come at quite a young age. So there's a temptation to feel that his career tailed off, but he was a beautiful player to watch and tremendous footballer. But he went to Marseille, and I'm not sure Rob will know whether it... Did he play in a European Cup final or something like that at
Didn't
Marseille?
Didn't he go the year after?
He went August 91. They won the final in the summer of 91.
Yeah.
There was obviously a magnificent amount of money washing going on, wasn't there?
Yeah, because that's another fee.
Allegedly.
Even more bizarre than the Chris Waddle one, I think. Far more bizarre. That 5.5 million quid, and I'm Gary will disagree, no doubt, but I didn't see him as being a 5.5 million pound player.
You could arguably say the same about Platt. Platt had a great status, of course. I'm with both of you in a way. I think he was a really, really good player. I'm quite underrated, but I suppose, five and a half is quite a lot.
I mean, Platt for me, I mean, if the two, I mean, Platt, that was a year after the World Cup that he won. It wasn't on the back of a World Cup. We all know how some of those transfers don't work out. He had another year at Villa, and I think it's the year that Villa sort of pushed Liverpool to the title.
No, it wasn't. It was year after. They almost went down. But he had a very good season.
I mean, for me, David Platt for the same fee as Trevor Stephen, there's no contest.
Just a very quick aside. You're right, it was a year after Italian 90, but after Italian 90, English footballers became kind of must-have accessory in Serie A. Now, none of them went through in the end, but all the players were linked, and like Lineker, you know, my favourite story is Steve Bull, who was really close to moving to Torino until he decided he'd miss his English breakfasts.
He wouldn't even move from the Midlands, never mind to another country. Yeah, so Platt went, and obviously he had a very, he went to Bari, and that was a big deal.
Bari went down, but again,
he moved on, didn't he? He went to Sampdoria, Juventus.
Sampdoria, then Juventus.
He properly ingratiated himself in the culture, didn't he? Which again, is quite important.
Yeah, I mean, he worked at Man City, I think, that's helping Mancini at the beginning, particularly in terms of translating, which tells you how his Italian is.
And he'd have played with Mancini at Samp as well.
Right, yeah.
Think. We're up to nine.
He would have been second banana to Mancini, though.
We're up to 1992 now. You talk about a player didn't look like he moved much. That was Roberto Mancini, by the way. But and I don't mean that as a criticism. It was just he just glide around and be amazing. But yeah, so we're up to 1992 now because that was 91. 1992. Now the big move in 1992 was Paul Gascoigne going from Tottenham to Lazio. In 5.5 million again from a British point of view, but three big moves in 1992 in the international arena. Papin went from Marseille to Milan for 10 million. Viali went from Sampdoria to Juventus for 12 million. And the famous Gianluigi Lentini went from Torino to Milan for £13 million. That's what happened in 1992. And of course, Lentini then had a terrible accident, didn't he?
Yeah, he had a good first season. Then he had a car crash, and there'll be people who know more about it, but I think he wasn't quite the same. Yeah, Papin was in the period when they were stockpiling foreign players, and of course you could only play three. Mm-hmm. So you had people like, I think Brian Laudrup spent about 8 months on the bench, and I don't think they had a reserve team either. Papin would have played a fair bit and was absolutely ruthless.
Everyone remembers that having to navigate that horrendous foreigners rule in Championship Manager 92 on the Commodore Amiga. I certainly do, anyway. Yeah, and Viali, obviously, and Lentini.
Yeah, I mean, going back to Gazza, I mean, that was deferred by a year, I think, obviously, after his big injury. And I mean, it's kind of a cliche, but it's kind of obvious. I mean, the player that he was up until that injury with this. I mean, you watch that cup run that Spurs have, and again, it's a YouTube thing, but you watch that cup run that they got to the final, and he dragged them to that final. And the style of goal that he would score pre-91 would often be very different. He would score great goals post that 91 injury, you know, and everyone remembers the goal at Wembley in 96, but it was never quite the sort of bursting past three players kind of goal that he would score, which he made like his own almost trademark, certainly in on these shores in that cup run.
Yeah, I agree. I think he was still a fantastic player after 91, but he wasn't quite the same. Something died in him. Probably that, but you're right, that kind of explosiveness. He was never quite the same again. Still a fantastic player.
The other thing about that move to Lazio, I mean, we all know, of course, he scored the winner in the Rome Derby, and I think he's still, despite some controversial moments in terms of, you know, being the Brit aboard, belching into the microphone and stuff that we remember, but he's actually was really popular.
They loved him, yeah.
Yeah, and I heard an anecdote about him one day when he's in Rome, and there's fans banging on the car while he's driving through Rome, and these are a Lazio and Roma fans. It was almost like he was a phenomenon from all parts of Italy, but particularly Roman. And these fans are banging on the car from Roma, you know, cheering Gazza, not cheering.
I've never seen a player who represents what it must feel like to be the fan who's playing.
There's very
few players where you've gone, you know what, that's exactly what I'd be like. I'd be pulling faces, I'd be dicking about, I'd enjoy every minute of it. Of course, you probably wouldn't when it became your job, but it never seemed like a job to him, did it? He just delighted in it, and he delighted everybody in the way he played as well.
Someone who was close to him at the time, who I spoke to once, actually also said his Italian was all right. He sort of, his grammar sort of sucked, but he could get by. You know,
Danny Baker in his... one of his three volumes of autobiography says that Gazza spoke perfect Italian.
I mean, I spoke to James Richardson on this. He's also the guy who told me about the story with the banging on the cars. And he said that his grammar wasn't great, but, you know, for a guy that we don't always associate with being, you know, international and that bright, I think, you know, he said that his Italian was all right and far better than some other players that went to Italy.
That's Gascoigne in 92. We then move on to... jumps 3 years to January 1995 when Andy Cole goes from Newcastle United to Manchester United for 7 million, John.
Yeah, I mean, when I mentioned earlier about these kind of cloak and dagger moves and suddenly springing a surprise, I mean, obviously Cantona springs to mind a few more, but this was one that came out of absolutely nowhere. I remember United had played a game against Sheffield United, I think it was on a Monday night, in the FA Cup third or fourth round with a great chip from Kavanagh. And then next day woke up and they signed Andy Cole for $7 million.
There was actually a clue, but not that we knew at the time, that Keith Gillespie had been left out of that Sheffield United game because he didn't want to come to... You're right, I think it was one of the last kind of JFK transfers. You vividly remember.
Can you imagine it now? With all the people camped outside.
What my favourite bit about that is that Keegan actually goes out and confronts him, doesn't he? Actually just like, he says, look, you know, there's a little bit where he says, look, if it goes wrong, I know the implications.
And he says something, doesn't he, like, oh, if I think I can move this club on, then I'm going to do it. But, you know,
and he bought Fernand. But yeah, no, it just sums up Keegan, bless him. That he actually went out and just actually wanted to have a chat with the people about it and say,
Gary?
The story that I like about this, and it underlines the Bolt from the Blue character, is there was a guy in the Daily Mirror the day after the Andy Cole transfer, and it was one of those shots with him looking glum in one picture, and then there was a club, and the day before the Andy Cole transfer, he'd had his calf tattooed with a picture of Andy Cole in a Newcastle kit. There he was, looking glum for the photographer. But I think I was travelling to York or something that day. But I remember being at York Station and hearing it on the radio or something or other like this. And it really was. How did that happen?
Did Cole want to go? Did he want to go, Cole?
I think he was just quite. I don't think he agitated. I don't know, to be honest, but I don't think so. I think it was just that Keegan, because what happened was actually Ferguson, they're all interlinked. Ferguson wanted Collymore first.
Yeah.
And Frank Clark was basically bored of saying no. So he got his assistant to lie and say he had a cold or something. So then Keegan, I think Ferguson spoke to Keegan about something and he said the response he got, it wasn't a it just made him think, hang on, something's not right there. It was about a month before it happened. And then it kind of went from there because Ferguson was looking at everyone. Funnily enough, he said he decided against Sheringham because he was too old. Then he bought him two years later. but United looked at Ferdinand ended up going to Newcastle. It was a really interesting time because all the big English clubs were signing young English forwards.
And for about 18 months after that, I mean, as you said, Ferdinand went to Newcastle, I think, the summer afterwards. And the beginning of the following season, when Newcastle were on fire and United were struggling, Cole was under a lot of pressure, and I was thinking, because Ferdinand was £1 million cheaper, I think he was £6 million, although I guess when you throw in the Keith Gillespie thing, but anyway, I thought, my goodness me, Ferguson's dropped the wicket here and should have got Ferdinand.
I think a lot of people did. I thought Cole showed extraordinary mental strength to recover from a diabolical first 18 months. Yep. He then got pneumonia at the height of summer. He then had both legs broken in one tackle by Neil Ruddock in a reserve game. He had Cantona's awful body language that made it clear he didn't rate him.
Yeah.
To recover from all that, I thought was so impressive. And he basically, United bought a goal scorer and made him into a footballer. I thought he became a really good link player.
Yeah. I saw United win 4-2 at Goodison, and Dwight York was playing with Andy Cole. And I think, I'm trying to think of a better pair that I saw, or two players just tear a defence apart. More than those two, because they could have had 10 between them. That good. The speed of passing, the speed of thought, the runs, the intelligence shown, they absolutely were fantastic.
I'm going to be really annoying and remind you it was 4-1, not 4-2.
Yes, you're right. That's why you're here, Rob. That's why you're here.
I think Jesper Blomqvist scored in that game.
And I was actually there.
So that was...
Cole, there was always an accident-prone element. Even when he really nailed his United career, he could still miss big chances.
That was the England cap thing, wasn't it? He needs too many chances to score and all that kind of stuff.
To me, that's bollocks. It wasn't the quantity, it was the quality. He wouldn't miss that many, but he would miss some beasts. Not only great chances, but big moments, like Real Madrid in 1990. But
did he miss a chance at West Ham to win the title?
He missed two, exactly. And that kind of bled into next season when he had an absolute nightmare. Yeah. But anyway, just one quick aside on Cole and his England career. I think his first four caps were under four different managers, which is a bit weird. And maybe that contributed to a sense of never kind of feeling like...
Pop quiz, listeners to the pod. Can you still tell us who the four different managers were? I know you probably can't, Rob, but can you tell us that Neston Dorma, part of the four different managers were? Wilkinson was probably one of them.
But yeah, well, Keith Taylor.
No.
He would have been Hoddle. He would have been Hoddle.
Venables, Hoddle, Wilkinson, and Keegan.
Don't bother sending the answers in now. We're just giving it to you. So So that was Andy Cole in 1995. We then move into, still in 1995, a bit later that year, Dennis Bergkamp goes from Inter to Arsenal for $7.5 million. Again, that went okay, didn't it, in the final analysis?
You don't remember him being ridiculed in the tabloids. It took him a couple of, I think it took him about 6 weeks to score, and they drew, I think they drew at Hartlepool in the League Cup.
Can't handle English football. Is that classic?
What I would say, there's a really nice story, just quickly, about Ian Wright was at Clackett Lane service station. He was trying to park to get some petrol, and he was pissed at some BMW parked really badly, and he thought, who's this prick, basically? And then he saw Dennis Bergkamp and said, what are you doing? What the hell? And then Bergkamp told him he'd actually signed for Arsenal, and Wright said he'd be jumping around like a child, basically. And he was going to play alongside Dennis Bergkamp. It's a really nice story. But and Wright, I think it's Wright who says Arsenal will never make a more important signing, and I would agree with that. It just, he just changed the whole kind of culture of the club before Wenger, and just him.
More than Klinsmann, did he change the whole attitude to foreigners coming here, do you think?
I mean, the thing with Bergkamp as well is that was off a pretty dodgy period, I think, he had at Inter before that. And, of course, it was a Bruce Rioch signing. It was about maybe 2 months before Wenger arrived.
It was longer, but the thing is, it was a year, but I always wondered about this. Was it a David Dean signing with Wenger in mind? Was it Bruce Rioch? I never know, because on one hand, I think you should give Bruce Rioch a lot of credit, because he bought Bergkamp and Platt. Now, Platt was a different player, but in terms of status, they'd be buying people like Kawamya, you know? So it kind of gave a real... But I don't know whether it was David Dean with Wenger in mind. I really don't know.
Chris Kawamya. There's a blast. Yeah.
Gary.
Sort of got a hat-trick against that and Chris Kawamya.
Is there anybody you haven't seen score a hat-trick against Everton, Gary?
I was in a Highbury crowd where Dennis Bergkamp, his first touch of the ball, was greeted with screams of flop. Flop, flop. And that was coming from the Everton fans. But I suspect it might have been coming from some of the Arsenal fans as well, because he had had a poor season at Inter Milan. He had been, partly that was because he was the golden boy at Ajax, I think, wasn't he? The big book was he was coming through from Dutch football. And he wasn't at that time. But there was more than just the Everton fans who were unhappy with Bergkamp because he was on big money and it was seen as sort of Billy Big Bollocks coming through there, but that didn't last very long. Put it that way.
Two years he was pretty good. Yeah, first 2 years he was good. I don't think he was exceptional, but in the start of the third season when they went on to win the double, when he scored that famous hat trick at Leicester, and for about 2 months he played some astonishing football.
Well,
he really
played
did.
A bit deeper then, I think. I mean, as a leader of the attack, he was never the point of the attack. He was better just off or coming from deeper.
They had quite an interesting
and I think they
system.
Signed him as a centre forward, and he was never a centre forward.
They had quite an interesting system under Wenger because they had kind of Overmars and Parler were normally the wingers, but actually Parler was almost doing two jobs. So he would play as a central midfielder and a right midfielder, which allowed Bergkamp and Overmars to bugger around wherever they wanted, and then they would play right or an Elk in front. It was quite a clever, fluid system. And Bergkamp, I mean, he just saw passes that other... His ability to play short-range through passes that no one else could conceive, never mind play, it was just extraordinary.
His goal against
itself, famously, with that goal of the season to Newcastle.
Yeah, I was going to say, his goal against Newcastle was just... It's still probably the best goals I've ever seen.
Genuinely, I still can't work it out. If I watch that, it's like it's such a brain buster. I still can't work out the sequence of how he's conceiving it. My only thing is that people say he got lucky. I'm inclined to think he didn't, but his celebration is so low-key. And if you contrast that with the goal against Argentina, now for a kind of perfectionist artist like him, you would think he would go absolutely mental when he scored a goal. Having said that, it was like early in a league game as opposed to last minute of the World Cup final.
Was it Gabbitas he turned?
Yes, it was, yeah.
Yeah, I think Gabbitas.
He's backing into him, wasn't he? And he pushed the ball one way and spun the other way around.
Yeah, exactly.
And in a way, when it doesn't look barnstorming, people go, that's not as good as that goal when he crashed
into
the top
corner.
But actually, it's spectacular.
Yeah, it is. I agree. I think it's better than his one against Argentina, which is still... won the great World Cup goals, but yeah, it's one of the most obviously unique goals I think that's ever been scored, that Bergkamp goal against the
Cup. You mentioned a hat trick at Filbert Street there. I showed my boy Jesper that, and I think his reaction was, they were all in the same game.
There's a slight myth about the hat trick, at the risk of being really boring, is that all three were one goal in a month, one, two, three. That's actually not true. One of the three that won goal in a month was scored at Southampton when he beat about four players. I feel like the Grinch now, but
yeah. Yeah, I was going to say, Rob Smart, ruining your conceptions one thing at a time. We're still in 95, in the same summer, actually, when for £1 million more than Dennis Bergkamp, Stan Collymore went from Forest to Liverpool, John.
Yeah, and again, first thing that springs to mind is when he scores on his debut, and I think it's Clive Tilsley shouts, "You get what you pay for."
Yeah, summer like that, yeah.
It's like you want a trip to the supermarket.
He's Stan Collymore famously got beaten up in Dublin by Bath Rugby Club. I don't know if you've ever heard that story. He was in a nightclub in Dublin and Bath were over there. He decided to start a fight with Bath Rugby Club, which is sensible, isn't it? But there you go. Yeah, so he signed for Liverpool. But I think you were saying in the Liverpool episode the other week, Rob, that very divisive opinion about Collymore. Somebody said, you're basically managerial suicide. And then suicide, also.
No. Yeah, but against that, because though he did an infamous interview with 442 quite early on when he said, basically, in what industry would you spend 8 million and not know how to use it? Because basically, Liverpool wanted, he was obviously all kind of power and pace running at people and everything. Liverpool wanted him to play a lot, kind of cuter game. There was a short passing game. And he adapted pretty well in the first season. If you watch towards the end of the season, he makes quite a lot of goals for Fowler by moving left and things like that. But by the he was home, he didn't move to Liverpool, and there were a lot of problems. He didn't get on with Fowler. And some people will say he kind of ruined the dressing room. Other people will say he just, you know, was just a good player, didn't quite settle.
I think there are stories about his lack of punctuality as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And excuses, his mum would always be ill.
Roy Evans gave him
that. No, seriously. That
we've all worked with him.
But it's interesting.
John gave him an easy time as well, I think.
John Barnes compared him to Ronaldo, interestingly, in terms of kind of explosive pace, power, two-footed, skill. And he did have every... I'd love to know what would have happened had he gone to United and played under Ferguson.
Why didn't he go to United in wrong time?
Frank Clark kept saying no. And then they got Cole. But I think Collymore was his first choice. If you read, Ferguson did a really brilliant diary of the 94-5 season, and there's a period when he's thinking about, he basically wants to sign a striker after they go out of Europe. He considers all of them, but I think Collymore goes to Old Trafford and scores a belter, and that's kind of, then he decides he's the one, but they ended up with Cole and everyone was happy.
Larry?
Mate of mine lived next door to, I think it was Dean Gordon, the Crystal Palace fullback.
Went to Middlesbrough Dean Gordon. Yeah.
That's how I managed to find myself in one of the boxes at Selhurst Park when Palace were playing Southend. Now, Collymore played for both those clubs, but I think he was playing for Southend. And your point about Ronaldo, that's the Brazilian Ronaldo, not the Portuguese Ronaldo, it's well made, because I remember that he was just this huge man with this extraordinary burst of pace. He was very indisciplined at that time. He was a bit raw. But to say he was a couple of notches above that second division fare, well, he certainly was, I can tell you that. And you could see why people were paying big money for him. Although, of course, there was lots of stuff going on with Collymore. You've just mentioned that. But in terms of physical attributes and power and pace, I mean, Les Ferdinand always scored against Everton, and he had plenty of it. But I think Collymore had more.
He had more class as well, and he was two-footed. But Ferdinand was so powerful. That's another. Just a quickie on Collymore. I thought it was really cruel that after he had a bit of a few kind of lost years and everyone abused him for being depressed, which is true, you know, the attitude was so hostile towards mental illness back then. But he went to Leicester under Martin O'Neill, and he played brilliantly for a few months, was really settling in, even though there was an incident when he let off a fire extinguisher in the manga, but anyway. And he was doing so well, and it like felt like his career was back on track. And then O'Neill went and took the Leicester job, Celtic job, and his career never really recovered from that. I felt that was really sad. He's got a home, I think he's got a hat-trick on his home debut against Sunderland. Clearly got on with O'Neill, you know, two very intelligent people. O'Neill also had the gift of man management that perhaps Evans didn't, and John Gregory at Villa certainly didn't. I felt sad actually, because
what gift did John Gregory actually have? That's an episode all in itself. Yeah,
I always wanted Collymore to succeed, and he's the first person I interviewed who used a word I didn't understand. I wish I could remember what it was.
His book
is a sensation read.
He's got his own production company now. He was advertised on Twitter for people he's employing and all that kind of stuff, and all of that. Plus, you know, the Ulrika Johnson thing. Let's not go there.
I think he's you were talking about Paul Merson in terms of kind of interesting characters and journeys. I think he's just a really interesting lost talent. And also kind of the football, would he be the first British footballer who was quite openly spoke about mental health issues?
I think he's certainly one of them.
Now, the problem is, I think that actually set football back because the perception of Colin Moore was an oddball. I'm not saying that's fair. I don't think it is. I think whereas in cricket, someone like Truscothick was the first. And because he was an everyman, I think it made it a lot easier for people subsequently. Whereas Colin Moore, you know, there was that famous John Gregory quote about, you know, I just don't understand how he could be on that money and blah, blah, blah. Gary's gone.
Gary's just wandered off.
I bore Gary to tears. But yeah. I just think it's got a lot of interesting facets of his career. Obviously, there's some things that were entirely regrettable, like beating Ulrika up. And, I just think it's interesting.
I think in many ways, he was more of a classic Fergie striker than probably Andy Cole was.
Yeah, possibly. Absolutely. And Fergie, there's a good bit where he talks about it with his scouts and with his staff, and they say, are you sure he can link? And then he plays Old Trafford and plays really well, and Fergie's like, trust me, he can link.
I also remember that game because Forrest's kit that day was horrid. It was like a two-toned turquoise and blue kind of outfit.
That was also the game when Stuart Pearce racially abused Paul Lindsay. It was all brushed under the carpet.
Really?
Yeah. But yeah, I agree. I think he was. There was certainly more work to do on Cole as well. However, you do wonder, I suppose Ferguson was such a genius manager, quite like O'Neill in a way, but obviously even better. I suspect Colin Moore would have responded to him in a way that he didn't with Roy Evans. That's not to say it's Evans' fault, you know, it's just certain characters.
Just didn't quite fit, yeah. Sometimes you don't know how to do with people who work for you. You don't know what to do with them. You know?
No, exactly. No, totally, yeah.
But I'm just saying it's just that's just how it is sometimes, isn't it? What's, before we finish off with Shearer, because we're getting there now, I think just
really done.
Yeah, just a very quick thing is, it's interesting when I look back, particularly in the early 90s ones, about who's not on the list. Chris Sutton's not on the list. Roy Keane's not on the list, for example. Who actually, if you'd have asked me to list this off the top of my head, I would probably start throwing it, probably because I'd forget about Waddle. I'd forget about... Go on, Rob.
Because in those days, it was often... The British transfer record was often perceived as between British clubs.
That's
so
right.
Keane and Sutton would both be on the list then.
That is true, yeah.
Sutton, certainly. Right. I think that's why we remember them that way.
I mean, Keane was probably up there with, you know, sort of Brian Robson was just a no-brainer. But the thing, actually, at that time, that the Keane transfer, I remember there was sort of this list of Forest players that had gone between Forest and United that just flopped.
Burtles
being the classic. And so it was like, is he going to break the mould? And he certainly did.
A really quick one on Keane is, shows how precarious things are. Ferguson left that so late that had the... this admin staff at Blackburn not buggered off early on a Friday afternoon, Keane would have signed for Blackburn. He'd agreed it. And they buggered off so he couldn't do the contract. Then over the weekend, Fergie called him, just casual as you like, do you want to come for a chat? They had a game of snooker. And then Keane broke his word with Dalgleish, who said, basically, not quite your dead son, but not far away. No one does that. So it's just really interesting how casually Ferguson seemed to be about it.
I mean, the Cantona is the classic casual sort of phone conversation, isn't it? I mean, the other thing with Keane, I mean...
Imagine Keane and Shearer at Blackburn. That's a hell of a...
And then there's a classic line,
some spine, isn't it? Yeah.
So you had these kind of... I think it was like one year after another where Blackburn United were going for the big players at the time. Obviously, Shearer was in 93, I think, and eventually chose Blackburn. And during that dialogue, I think, again, in one of Ferguson's books, he mentions how his line to Shearer was, what would Kenny Dalglish do? And Shearer's response is like, you know, who fucking cares, you know, I'll do whatever I want, you know.
Yeah,
so that was an occasion that maybe Ferguson's sort of mental prowess didn't quite come off. But when it came to Keane was in no doubt which one he preferred.
I think he sold Keane a line, something like, look, son, we're going to win the English League for most of this decade with or without you, but with you, we'll win the European Cup.
Okay, that's nice.
Which was, sort of cruelly true, but not true.
Isn't there a slightly different narrative on the Shearer transfer as well?
Well, there are two. So 92, he definitely wanted to go to Blackburn, but there are two stories in 96. And one is that he wanted to go to United and agreed to go to United. And then Jack Walker, who loathed United, the Blackburn owner, basically said, no, you can go anywhere you like. You can go to bloody Bolton, Peterborough, Grimsby, but you're not going to that lot. Now, who do you believe? You know, Shearer says that he wanted to go to Newcastle. And what I would say is, my personal opinion is that he wanted to go to United and wasn't allowed. But I would say that it was a pretty tight decision at the time because Newcastle had only just missed out in the league. United, you know, you could easily put United's double the year before down to Cantona, Schmeichel and a bit of luck. At the time, not everyone knew the kids were going to be as good as they became. It's easy now to say Shearer would have scored a million goals, and he would have done, certainly before his cruciate injury, because he was a monster. Before he was injured in 97,
yeah,
he was just the perfect centre-forward of his type, an absolute monster. But don't forget that the temptation of going to your hometown club to win a title with them, and they were close, they were very
yeah,
close.
Which was looking very much on the cards, wasn't it?
So who do you believe?
Just before I bring you in, John, I just want to mention that the Shearer transfer to Blackburn, which was $15 million in 1996, is rather neatly sandwiched between Brazilian Ronaldo.
Once
in 96 with $13.2 million when he went from PSV to Barcelona, and then $19.5 million in 1997 when he went from Barcelona to Inter.
He broke the world record, I think, Ronaldo, twice before his 21st birthday. Remember. I mean, how good do you have to be to do that?
Sorry, yeah. John.
No problem. I mean, the other thing with the Shearer thing is we mentioned Andy Cole just now, and that was 18 months after the Cole $7 million deal. I mean, his career would probably have been over and would have been completely different had Shearer obviously made that move.
It worked, and also it's kind of sliding doors. It worked out well for United because they got Solskjaer, who became an absolute hero, but also because Shearer then did his cruciate a year later, and although he was still a brilliant goal scorer, he wasn't the same player.
I think he'd have still done all right with Beckham swinging the ball into even after his cruciate.
Yeah, but no, the first season when it had Cantona played through balls and Beckham put crosses in, he'd probably have scored. I think he would have scored 50 goals. But after that, he was a. It sounds stupid to say he was a diminished player, but he kind of was, really.
He was a diminished player. It's not unfair to say. He was just a different...
The Blackburn Shearer was oh, my God. It just scares me now thinking about him. How good he was.
A couple of points that I made earlier on that have parallels with Shearer.
And
not a paradigm shift. But I remember, and this will give you a flavour of the time, when Shearer was transferred to Blackburn... from Southampton, I remember going to Rothman's football yearbook because I wanted to compare the goals that had been scored by Tissier and Shearer, because my feeling was they got the wrong man. And if you look at and there's only 18 months between them, you kind of think Letizia was a lot older than Shearer, but he wasn't. He wasn't that much older. And in the first division season of 1990-91, Alan Shearer, 36 appearances for Southampton, 4 goals. Mm-hmm. In the same season, Matthew Letizia, 1990-91, also for Southampton, 35 appearances, 19 goals. And, you know, Letizia's goal-scoring record was incredible for a man who didn't really play as a forward. He played as a deep-line forward. But I remember having conversations saying, you know, they'll regret this, Blackburn Rovers. He's a one-season wonder. And he only scored 13 goals in that last season at Southampton. He's overrated. Should have gone for Letizia. So I got that wrong. And where we were talking, when I was talking earlier about Merson carving out two careers in one in football, one in broadcasting, with great success entirely on instinct. I want to kind of go the other way with Shearer, because he's from Wallsend in just outside Newcastle, and I thought I knew some pretty rough places near where I lived and in and around Liverpool, but dear me, Wallsend is really, really, really rough. And
he's from the same place as my dad, Gary, just to be careful.
Well, you'll know, Lee, that it's wrong. And Shearer's father, you know, famously was a sheet metal worker. My father was a panel beater, so I kind of have a kind of understanding a little bit of what it must have been like growing up. And he went, I think, to Southampton at something like 15 or 16, and it's a long way from Newcastle to Southampton. And that was much rarer than it is now, as a kind of big move away from where you grew up to go to Southampton.
He was a single-minded sod, though, wasn't he? I think he always has been.
He would say, learn his trade. And, you know, I commend him for that. And he improved as a footballer, and he changed his game as injuries supervened and as the nature of football changed. But he never stopped being effective. And I admire him for that as a footballer. And then when he started his punditry career, he was terrible. He didn't seem to do any homework. He was inarticulate.
Yeah, he was awful.
He was awful. Now I think he's right out of the top drawer. He does his homework. He's very clear in what he wants to say. I think he's a fine pundit who does a good job. And I'll just finish it off because I think he really worked hard at that broadcasting career, that we really saw it coming through with that documentary he did about neurological problems related to heading the ball, where I think that's as good a sports documentary as I've seen for quite a few years. Admittedly, I haven't seen too many of them. But he showed that he could pull that together. And okay, it was scripted, but he was still carrying the program for 60 minutes about quite a difficult issue to get across. And I think sometimes Shearer doesn't get enough credit for how hard he's worked to learn those two different trades. In a way that Merson does it all on instinct, I think Shearer does a lot of it on bloody hard work and trying to be the best he ever could be.
Just a point.
He also sort of, I mean, going back to the football, he also, you know, gives thanks to certain coaches. And he's really praises Terry Venables hugely for the build-up to Euro 96, because he went through a barren run, and I don't know the stats exactly. Maybe Rob can
it's
help.
It's gone for 2 years, I think.
Something like that, which obviously in those days would probably be about 20-odd games, which is an insane amount of games to go without a goal. And he certainly repaid Venables his faith.
He made a big point about how much Bobby Robson taught him when he came to Newcastle. He said he taught him to play sort of on the half turn, and nobody had actually taught him to play before and stuff. He was a very sort of modern coach, Robson, despite being quite literally ancient, wasn't he, for so long? But just a point, Gary, the finest sports documentary I've ever seen, if anybody's got a few days spare, is Ken Burns' 20-hour documentary about the history of baseball. 20 hours. It's brilliant. Absolutely brilliant.
I genuinely don't know if you're being serious.
No, I am genuinely being serious. I have never watched a game of baseball in my life, and it's one of the best documentaries I've ever seen. It's amazing.
Baseball is like cricket and boxing in attracting great writing, and so it's no surprise that to me. So I shall look out.
And
for
on
it.
That note, we shall bring this marathon to a close. thank you very much, Gary, Rob, and John. I hope you've all enjoyed this out there. Let us know what you think at Ness and Dorma Pod.
Thank you.
And we'll see you all again soon. Cheers. Take care.
Cheers, gents. Sports Social Podcast Network.